Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang, and the program is Fight the Empire. Before I get on to our guests, I'd like to make a little quick announcement. The local Pacific Center for Global Justice is offering fall seminars, and they start the second week of September. And there's two seminars that I'm aware of. And one is on militarism, and the other is on, let's see what the other one's about. Oh, four engagements. Call four engagements and how we can go more effectively work for justice locally and abroad. So anyway, that is the Pacific Center for Global Justice Fall Seminars. There is a charge for these. To get more information, you can go to www.pcgj.org or you can call 617-999-3689. So now on to our guest is Ellen Brown, who's the author of Web of Debt and numerous articles. The most recent, I just read it this morning for Yes Magazine on North Dakota's economic miracle. But this show, we're going to talk about something else because she's moving. She's written a lot about state banks, and we're going we're moving out a little bit to the Bilderbergers. We'll get to them later. Ellen Brown, are you there? Ellen Brown.
Hi.
Hello. Well, let's see. You are in Switzerland now. What are you doing there?
I had to speak in Malaysia at two conferences in Malaysia, and it's a long flight to Malaysia, so I talked them into layovers both ways. So I stopped off in London on my way there for another. I had to speak at a group, and then my daughter lives in Switzerland. So.
Oh, I thought maybe we're checking up on the Swiss bankers or something.
Actually, we're two blocks from the Bank for International Settlements.
Oh, I see. Well, let's talk about in your article on Standard & Poor. Now, they're the ones, the rating agency that gave the U.S. a lousy rating or a less than good rating, and the Bilderbergers. But you started out this article talking about the big roller coaster in the stock market, up one day, down the next day, big, huge swings. What's going on?
After September 1st, which was when Congress and the administration agreed on raising the debt ceiling after much compromise. I mean, it was all done at the last minute to prove that we would not default on our debt under any circumstances. So then on Friday, despite that, there was this downgrade by S&P, and immediately the Treasury Secretary talked to the S&P people and said that there was a $2 trillion mistake in their figures. So S&P looked at it, and they said, well, that's true, but we're going to downgrade anyway. So it was highly suspicious. It was as if they had decided to downgrade, and, you know, for some other reason. And this downgrade occurred after closing on Friday the 5th. And before that, for the 4 days before that, the market had gone up 400 or more and down 400 or more, up and down for 8 straight days. It went either up or it reversed course by 400 points each or more each day. So that was totally unprecedented. Now, I know it's no doubt the high-frequency program trading that makes these swings be bigger than they used to be, because 70% of trading is now done by computer after hours. And they're just skimming trades, you know. They're just front-running these trades and skimming profits off the top.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, these swings were remarkable. On Thursday, the thing that caused the big swing before the downgrade was something that happened in Europe, where it was anticipated that the mark-to-market rule would be relieved for European banks that were holding sovereign debt for that part of their...
Tell us what mark-to-market rule is.
Well, this is a rule imposed by the Bank for International Settlements, which says that you... Or originally, and then it's adopted by the countries, but it says that assets on the books of the banks have to be valued according to what they would fetch today. In other words, it was imposed when on us when there were all these mortgage-backed securities that the banks were holding, and nobody wanted them. They were collateralized debt obligations, so they were mortgage-backed securities wrapped in a derivative. And when it was discovered that they weren't protected from default like everybody thought they were, when some hedge funds started going bankrupt, suddenly there was no market at all for these collateralized debt obligations. So that is actually what caused our market to crash in November of 2007 when the mark-to-market rule was imposed on U.S. banks. And immediately, credit collapsed, the market collapsed, and we just never really recovered from that. But what happened was the banks had valued their assets a certain way, and then all of a sudden they have to value it a different way, which means suddenly they can't meet their capital requirements.
Right, their assets shrink. I mean, their assets.
And now suddenly they can't. And that's the same thing that in Europe you could fix all this trauma going on with the European banks if you allowed them to value those assets not as if there were this crisis. In other words, what they would fetch, I'm not sure how they do value them. I mean, it used to be they called it mark to fantasy, and that's the reason they criticized the old standard. But the thing is that's what's crippling the European banks, is that they're holding all this sovereign debt. That's the debt of countries that are teetering on bankruptcy. And therefore, nobody will buy that debt, and therefore there's no market for it. So they have to mark it down to far less than it's really worth.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can't satisfy their capital requirement, and then they can't make loans. So anyway, what was suspicious was, I looked to see what was happening because I'm in the stock market, and it was quite a throat-clutching experience. I mean, it was somebody is making a lot of money and somebody's losing a lot of money. I mean, it's so sudden and so unexpected. So I looked to see what was really going on, and apparently the man who is in charge of the S&P, the CEO, he's since quit or was laid off or was replaced. But the man who was then CEO of S&P had been to Bilderberger meetings, and he's blamed the U.S. as being responsible for the global troubles, and sort of had an axe to grind, you would say. Anyway, he was the man that pushed through this downgrade, even though there was many people have looked at it and said there was really no reason for the downgrade, particularly not then, a week after we had proved that we weren't going to default. So and then the man who was responsible for the Thursday thing also had been to he's also a Bilderberger person. So I looked to see what the Bilderberger agenda was, and it's basically these are a group of financiers, all the big financiers meet once a year in Europe somewhere. It used to be totally secret, but now they're we all find out ahead of time what their agenda is. I mean, they haven't managed to keep it secret anymore. So these are all big business people whose goal is what George Ball, who was the Undersecretary of State in the 1960s, said he called it the world company. Mm-hmm. So the goal is to buy up the world, essentially, privately.
Let's tell our people exactly who the Bilderbergers are. The name comes, they were formed back in the 50s, I think 1954, and their first meeting was in Holland at the Bilderberg Hotel, and that's where their name came from. And I'm wondering now, there are these other meetings of these global ruling elites. You know, there's the Bohemian Grove sessions, and then there's the Davos meetings. All these different groups, are they the same people and different setups, or what is the deal here?
Well, it does look that way. I mean, they certainly are. They all meet at the Bilderbergers, and they're generally have the same agenda. The other thing that I thought was suspicious, well, I had read this. Somebody said before that shocking drop on the 8th, it was August 8th, 2011. So somebody had said I just saw it on the internet. But before that happened, watch out for 8811. It's one of those Illuminati numbers. And that was the day that the market dropped farther than it had dropped at any day before or since 9/15/11, which was the day that Lehman Brothers collapsed. So it all looks orchestrated. That was the fishy thing. And so, and the other amazing thing was, why didn't this market just keep going down like it did, after Lehman Brothers collapsed? There's some other force that's working to prop it back up. So on Tuesday, the 9th, the market turned right around and shot right back up. And that was because the ECB, the European Central Bank, decided or announced that they would, after all, basically do quantitative easing, print money, and bail out Italy and Spain. Before they were resisting doing that because it's sort of a violation of the Maastricht Treaty, which is their EU treaty.
Well,
you're not supposed to be creating money in this system. The idea is to have a stable amount of money that doesn't grow, and that's actually how bankers get control, is by limiting the amount of money that's out there. So they're necessarily defaults.
Now, in your article, you talk about sort of titanic forces that are sort of boosting the market and crashing the market, sort of working in opposition. So now apparently the Bilderbergers are one of the forces that are trying to crash the market. Who is trying to boost it?
Well, there are strong forces that are trying to hold the EU together, and there are other forces that are trying to collapse it. So it would be the forces trying to hold it together. I mean, I would see them as, the Titans in Greek mythology. They were both, neither one was a hero. They were all fighting each other. Mm-hmm. So it does seem to me that, or I've read that there there are two big banking forces going on here. There's the old European bankers that would basically be out of the city of London now. Their control center is the city of London, or you could call it Basel, Switzerland. And then there's sort of the upstart. Well, we would be in the upstart category, the upstart bankers were doing quantitative easing, which is contrary to the rule imposed by the Bank for International Settlements that all their members are supposed to aim for a stable money supply, which means you can't create money. The government can't print money, and the government can't borrow from its own central bank, which prints money. Only banks get to create money, and that's where they get control. But, of course, they don't reveal that part, that they actually do create money every time they make a loan.
Mm-hmm.
So you could argue, I would actually argue that Ben Bernanke is on the other side, where he's trying to create money. Anybody who's trying to get more money out there so you won't have this wave of defaults and depression and so forth would be the other side of this titanic battle.
So do the Bilderbergers, do they actually publish their agenda? How do we know what their agenda is? Their meetings are kind of secretive, and I sort of wonder if that's sort of a little mystique that they're cultivating just to kind of keep people off balance or something. But anyway, they meet kind of undercover, and they talk. How do we know what their agenda is?
Well, Daniel Estulin always reports on what they're up there. They have moles, I guess, that managed to get in. And then Tucker, I can't remember his first name, but there's another man that reports regularly.
Oh, Jim Tucker, yes.
Yeah, right, Jim Tucker. So
they sort of tell us what these guys are talking about, and they are mostly guys. But Daniel Estulin has written about the Bilderberger agenda, and he talks about this the ideology of the one world company. Now, what is that, the world company?
Well, that is what this man, George Ball, he first used the term back in, I think it was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that they would own everything. They're not so much interested in governing, but they want to own everything privately so that government becomes irrelevant. If you're in control of the purse strings, you don't need government. Government needs you. And the way that they own everything is, the system for a couple hundred years now has been to create depressions. In other words, there'll be bubbles where you get a lot of credit out there, and then people borrow based on all this flowing credit. And then there's a, you contract the money supply, so there's just not enough money anymore. So people can't pay principal plus interest on all these debts they've incurred. So they have to go bankrupt. So they put their farms and their homes into bankruptcy, and then the people who do have money, who saw this coming, basically because they planned it, as you might say happened in those 2 weeks, for example, they jump in and buy everything up. And interestingly, on August 5th, I read somewhere that somebody had put in a huge short sale or a huge bet that S&P would downgrade when everybody thought they wouldn't. And if they win that bet, they would get $1 trillion out of the deal. It was like, I think they made 1,000% or something on the bet.
Mm. It's an $850 million bet, and they would get about $1 trillion. Wow, that's a big return.
Yes, so that alone could explain why, even though they were $2 trillion off in their figures, they said no, we're going to go through with it because somebody had money riding in it.
It's like they're rigging the market in a way.
Exactly.
Now, getting back to S&P, I mean, all right, they are a private company, and they are one of, I guess, is two or three others that are sort of ratings agencies, and S&P does not have a very good record, but what gives them the power to, kind of rate what the governments are doing and cause a market to rise and fall like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is an unbelievable.
Why are they allowed to do this?
All these big entities like pension funds, mutual funds, et cetera, they're only allowed to buy AAA-rated assets, investments. And so if they're holding a lot of some, like obviously treasuries, there's huge investments in treasuries. Everybody's got treasuries. All those big funds have treasuries. And if suddenly they're downgraded and they...
Then they got to sell them.
They got to sell them suddenly, so then they'll all get dumped on the market. Now that didn't happen. In fact, funnily enough, the treasuries got more valuable because usually these clauses say that two out of three of these big rating companies have to downgrade them, and only one did it. But it's just the threat, you know. It always rattles the market, and then everybody thinks, oh no, there's going to be a giant crash, the dollar's going to collapse, so then everybody bails out of the market. And then when they sell all their stocks, and then somebody else snatches them up very cheaply, and then it all goes back up.
Well, it seems to me that here you have this private company can do all this, seems to be an open door to kind of rigging, gaming the market so that they or their friends make huge profits.
Yeah, I know. It's a horrible system.
But here we are. Are we really stuck with this, or is there any way out of all this?
Well, the SEC is investigating, but you know that's the trouble. The regulators they're owned as well. I mean, they all seem to be in the pockets of the big companies that they're supposed to be regulating.
How long can this investigation go on, do you think?
I don't know.
A long time. Wow. Well, okay. So let's sort of just sum up. I mean, Standard & Poor's, they gave the treasuries, they lowered the rating, which kind of threw things into disarray. And the head of S&P was one who led this downward push. And then and his, apparently, he believes that the U.S. is the problem, that somehow the Bilderbergers, he seems to be acting on behalf of the Bilderbergers. He's been to their meetings, and part of their agenda requires that the U.S., that the dollar gets replaced. Now, tell us about that. That's sort of, do you think that the global big shots would want to keep the dollar strong, but apparently not?
Well, that's what I think. There are at least two factions, but there is a faction that wants to collapse the dollar and wants to bring the U.S. down to the level of a third world country.
Why do they want to do that?
Because you can't really impose one that, you know, they're always saying that the goal is one world government, mm-hmm. a one world currency. You can't get people to accept, to give up their own currencies and beg to have this new currency imposed unless they're in dire straits. You know, they're not going to, you have to shake things up in order to get people to accept your new world order.
So if they downgrade the U.S., then they can, that gives them more, say, what we might call buying opportunities or something.
Yeah, well, if they could cause another collapse like that one in the fall of 2008, but they didn't actually do it. You know, another interesting thing, if you put any faith in these numbers, it was actually on 9/11/2008 that Lehman Brothers was heavily, it was the victim of a bear raid.
Mm-hmm.
Their stock dropped by 30%, and that was what caused them to be bankrupt. They wouldn't have been bankrupt other than that. So that, too, is an orchestrated raid.
Do they really, does numbers matter that much to them, except just the numbers on the bottom line? Or because, I mean, 9/11 was also when Salvador Allende was overthrown in Chile back in 73.
Uh-huh. So and I hesitate to bring that up because it does sort of blow my credibility, but it's interesting. There are some highly interesting and suspicious numbers out there.
Hmm. Well, you know, I kind of wonder what, why do we, you know, maybe the fundamental question is, since everything is at sort of the mercy of investors, why do we need investors? Why did the economy depend on them? How did we get into that situation?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the whole thing needs to be rethought. Our whole model is wrong because that's the reason there's never enough money in the system to pay for the products because mm-hmm. Investors are making the money. And it's the, I mean, I'm an investor myself, and I'm talking against my own interests, but if we had a different system, if we had a decent Social Security, the way it is right now, everybody thinks that they have to make their money make money because at some point they will be too incapacitated to work and Social Security is not enough to live on. Mm-hmm. Or they might not even have Social Security. So they have to have this other income. But if your money's making money, who is it? It's either taking money from someone
mm-hmm.
or it's inflating the money supply. I mean, there's only two ways that money can make money. Either one is not a sound, stable, or fair way to create the system. It would be better if people got paid for their labor and everybody got a decent Social Security and everybody got a decent health care, et cetera. All those things. For example, I was in Sweden a year ago, and there they pay 50% taxes, but they have a perfectly good Social Security, good health care, education's paid through higher education. So they don't have to worry about saving up for all those things.
Mm-hmm.
So they just work through their normal work lives, and then they retire to their... So it's all very comfortable. You know, there's not a lot of stress involved.
Well, I think that this money-making money idea, this is just my own opinion. I think it's a result of 500 years of European conquest of the Americas. We've been on a kind of a 500-year growth and plunder cycle, which seems to be coming to an end, maybe within our lifetimes. And in that kind of environment, yeah, money can make money. But when you're back to the basics, after the system collapses, then what happens?
Yeah, and if money's making money, it's not making any products.
Mm-hmm.
What you want, I think it's fine for the money supply to increase, but the products should increase along with it. In other words, that money should be used to create things, and then you'd have a balanced system.
Do you think there's any chance of that? Do you think this system can go on much longer? I mean, I keep reading that it's on the verge of collapse, especially in Europe. Do you think that is going to come?
It'll collapse if they want it to collapse. I think it's another thing that's manipulated. It can
mm-hmm.
be saved if they, in order to be saved, they have to change the rules.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that you can have a finite fixed amount of money and allow banks to charge interest the way they all do, or, you know, and investors, et cetera. You can't keep paying interest, which means you're always paying back more money than you get,
mm-hmm.
without allowing the system to expand. But they could change the rules and say, all right, we're going to let the ECB create money and lend to all these countries, or let the countries borrow from their own central banks, which then would create credit. You know, they don't necessarily have to print euros, but mm-hmm. they could allow them to create the credit, or in other words, let them go farther into debt. It doesn't actually hurt to go into debt as long as you don't have interest attached. If it's a very low interest, like mm-hmm. in Japan, they owe that debt to themselves, so they've got a debt that's 240% of GDP, but their lifestyle is actually fine. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, they've got Social Security, health care, education paid for, et cetera. And the debt is owed to themselves. It's owed to the Bank of Japan, which is them. You know, it's their own central bank. And to the Japan Post Bank, which is where most people put their savings, and they get a little return on it. So they're all getting that money. So it works. If it would work to borrow from your own central bank interest-free. You could do that indefinitely, and it wouldn't hurt the economy, except to the extent, I mean, you'd need to bring the money back in mm-hmm. if prices started to inflate. But for a long time, you could put a lot more money into our economy without inflating prices, because you've got to put everybody to work.
So there is a way to a sustainable economy if we were willing
yeah.
to take it. Well, I think we're going to have to end there. I mean, it's sort of a hopeful note if we want to take that step. We've been talking with Ellen Brown, the author of The Web of Debt, and some really interesting articles. This one in Truth Out, Standard & Poor's and the Bilderbergers, and then an article that just came out today in Yes Magazine about North Dakota's economic miracle. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And this is another episode of Fight the Empire, and stay tuned for Air Cascadia.